Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of React Roundup. I am your host today, Paige Niedringhaus, and we are joined by TJ Van Tol.
Hey, everybody.
And Stephen Wittens is our special guest today.
Hello.
Welcome, Stephen. We're glad to have you on. Maybe you could introduce yourself to our listeners and give us a little bit about your background and why you're famous.
I don't know if I'm famous. I usually introduce myself as the guy with that website with that crazy header, because it's kind of my calling card. So the website in this case is acko.net, A-C-K-O.net. It has a very elaborate animated 3D piece in the header. And if you're wondering why it's called acko.net, it's because if you put www in front, it just says wacko. That's a 20-year-old joke, but it still works.
It does. And anybody who's listening, I would definitely encourage you to check out his website because it is very cool. There's music included. There's some awesome animations. But I think, Stephen, what we're actually going to talk about today first, at least, is a piece that you recently wrote called React, The Missing Parts.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, folks, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs. And lately, I've been working on actually building out Top End Devs. If you're interested, you can go to topendevs.com/podcast, and you can actually hear a little bit more about my story, about why I'm doing what I'm doing with Top End Devs, why I changed it from devchat.tv to Top End Devs. But what I really want to get into is that I have decided that I'm going to build the platform that I always wished I had with devchat.tv, and I renamed it to Top End Devs because I want to give you the resources that are going to help you to build the career that you want, right? So whether you want to be an influencer in tech, whether you want to go and just max out your salary and then go live a lifestyle with your family, your friends, or just traveling the world or whatever, I want to give you the resources that are going to help you do that. We're going to have career and leadership resources in there, and we're going to be giving you content on a regular basis to help you level up and max out your career. So go check it out at topendevs.com. If you sign up before my birthday, that's December 14th. If you sign up before my birthday, you can get 50% off the lifetime of your subscription. Once again, that's topendevs.com.
So what I've essentially been doing lately is playing with my own version of React. And where this came from was the realization that after doing a lot of front-end code with React, then moving back to back-end, I often found that like there'd be moments where I'd be like, oh, it'd be really handy if I could use a hook here, or it'd be really handy if I could just, you know, take this list of things that I'm making where only a couple of items are changing, just like in your UI, and I could just use React to do that. Mm-hmm. So out of this idea, I built my own React-like runtime. It's called Live, but it's essentially mostly a clone. But what it focuses on is the core part of React, just the notion of you have components that produce other components, you have hooks. So the very essence of React, but without the HTML part, really. It's just the internal part, because I want to use it for things that aren't UI. And so I've applied this to WebGPU to build a framework for GPU rendering on the web, and basically found that it's really great. It's all the benefits that you get when you work with React code, you can get in other domains that aren't necessarily UI, or they might still be rendering or drawing related. But you quickly discover that anything around that, any sort of orchestration or bookkeeping around that, if you write it in a reactive way, it becomes simpler and you get all the same benefits that you used to from UI land. And so as part of that, once you have your own copy of a framework, you can kind of just play around with it and experiment with it. And because it's more lightweight than the full React package that does HTML and has, you know, years and years of effort put into it, it's a lot easier to evolve it. And out of that came a couple of experiments. These are some interesting concepts that I think would be great if they were present in the main React library, but also that, you know, I can make use of now because I have my own tool set. And I'm just applying these patterns as much as I can because they make my life as a developer a lot nicer.
So this is very cool. I think the first question I'll ask just to start, it's very cool, but it's also quite ambitious, right? I think most developers that notice this sort of thing don't think, oh, well, to look into this more, I'm going to build my own version of React, right? So I'm curious, like, how did you go about starting something like that? Did you like have up like the React source code? Do you have some background in that? Or did you just kind of try to take it from a naive, let me just reverse engineer these APIs and sort of like as a learning exercise? I'm just sort of curious your approach when you took that on.
No, it's definitely a fair question. I should say I have a lot of experience. So I'm 38, but I've been pretty much been coding ever since I could reach a keyboard. So from a very young age, not that, you know, those first 10 years amounted to much, but still it means I have a lot of background in just UI concepts, rendering concepts, and those kinds of things. When I started with React, that would have been, I don't know, very early on. That was back when it was still mix-ins. I don't want to put a year on it because I'll get it wrong. But yeah, back when React still had mix-ins, that was before classes, way before hooks. So I watched that whole evolution kind of happen, mostly from the outside. But before that, too, I've worked with UI frameworks, worked with rendering engines, looked into, you know, various sort of UI paradigms. Like there's two fundamental concepts in this space. It's what's called immediate rendering or retained rendering. And kind of until React showed up, those were kind of the two only ways. And I would say what's great about React is it combines those two methods. It feels very immediate when you use it, but nevertheless, we all know it's retaining a whole bunch of stuff behind the scenes for you. So yeah, having that background helped. In terms of how you actually build it, it's a little bit of what you say, you know, just going at it from scratch, not worrying too much about how the official implementation does it. But at the same time, having worked with React a lot, having, you know, stepped into it using the debugger on numerous occasions, even just, you know, even when I don't want to, you kind of get a feel for what's inside there and the kinds of concepts that they're using, which is very useful. But I definitely approached it as I'm going to do a clean room implementation, exactly because it's not tied to all the same HTML legacy concerns. So I can I can get away with a lot more than they can. Basically, it doesn't have to be quite as
robust.
Yeah, quite as, well. No, robust definitely. Not quite just as complex. It's not juggling as many balls, and that just alone allows you to keep it a lot simpler. Yeah,
it's sort of, so back in the day, I've not done the same sort of deep dive with React, but I got really involved with a jQuery project, and I did a lot of similar type experiments where the jQuery source code can be incredibly intimidating, but you also have to realize that they're handling all sorts of edge cases for you that you probably don't need in your code, right? It's like some edge case that some, like, you know, they have to handle crazy, like different iframe usage, different, like all sorts of different browsers, lots of which you probably don't care especially about. And by taking like the naive, dumbed down approach, it can not only be a good learning experience, but it can also make some of this framework stuff seem less magical, I guess is one way of phrasing it too. Because it's not like it's insanely complicated under the hoods. There's just people maintaining all of this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, a good example of that is what happens when you don't have class components, when you only have functions and hooks. That's a whole chunk of complexity that just goes away.
Goodbye.
Yeah.
Exactly. The React team can't do that. I can do that. So it's more of these kinds of trade-offs that I've been making. There is, you know, there's an interesting conversation to be had, for example, about React 18 and where they're going, where they do seem to be becoming a bit more opinionated in terms of how they want it to work. Whereas I think before, until React 17, they were a little bit more just like, well, we don't want to steer you too much. We're going to let you do whatever you want, whatever you're comfortable with. I don't know if that's a good evolution. So from that point of view, it's also nice if, you know, people are exploring alternatives to copy a lot of the same benefits without necessarily having to adopt the whole stack wholesale.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the fact that the React core team has tried to make React as backwards compatible as they can as they've moved forward. But, you know, you can, if you keep up with what's going on in the world, you can see that there is definitely a trend toward hooks and I think that you have to assume as a developer that at some point they are going to stop supporting class-based stuff and you really need to move everything over or just say, this is the cutoff point. React 17 is where we're staying. You know, we're going to eventually hit that breaking point where we can't use classes. So, you know, I appreciate that. And I appreciate that they didn't do what Angular 2 did, which made it just completely incompatible with Angular 1 or AngularJS in any way, shape, or form. But I also understand that to keep the code base not so bloated and not so complex, eventually you just, like you said, you have to start going in a certain direction and cut out some cruft and just say, this is the direction we're taking. If you want it, go for it. If you are happy with what you've got, then just stop letting the versions increase.
Yeah, it's interesting too that the React team has spent the last, I think, two major releases kind of working on exactly that, on potentially having different versions of React running side by side. So mm-hmm. that this may be exactly what you're thinking, that they're just going to, you know, they're going to drop the class-based components, but still allow you to run old React in the way that it was back then. Mm-hmm. And then they can, you know, layer on newer concepts without having to carry it back.
I'm presuming too, as you were sort of building this up, that I'm guessing you were just building features of React as you needed it, right? Because you have no desire to be like API compatible, right? So if you didn't need a certain, like some of the more fringe hooks or like some of the features that people rarely use of React, I'm guessing you didn't go back through and feel a need to implement those more or less, just the stuff you need to get what you need done.
Yes, although I would say, you know, there's sort of the core set of hooks that are kind of essential, which is, you know, the state, the memos, and the context.
Yeah.
Those you can't get away from. But it's true. It's definitely not a full, you know, 100% implementation. There's a couple of the more esoteric hooks missing. Then again, I think a lot of those, if you look at them in React, a lot of them are also just sort of convenience wrappers that they don't necessarily depend on any special internal magic to do what they do. So that's definitely something nice that you realize once you start sort of tinkering with this at their lower level, is just how little you need to get something like React going. Like the concept of, you know, a functional component that could access hooks, that access, you know, a piece of state that is somewhere, but you don't really know where, you don't really care where. It's really not that complex once you build a little proof of concept from it. And then the rest is just, you know, how do I want to evolve it? Do I want to follow the same sort of design guidelines, the same principles? Do I want to break some of the rules? That in particular was the fun part, I think, that a lot of what are rules in React just don't apply anymore. So for example, like a big frustration I'm sure many people will have found is that you can't call hooks conditionally in React. We all know why you're not supposed to do it. It's mm-hmm. very nicely documented, but still sometimes you just want to do it. Mm-hmm. And you can't, because that would, you know, cause the hooks to shift around and change. But there's a workaround, which is this. Imagine you have an if statement, and inside that if statement, you call a hook, whether it's, you know, use memo, use context, whatever it is. And mm-hmm. then in the else branch, you just call use no context, use no state, use no memo, so that you're explicitly telling your runtime, like, hey, I skipped a hook, and it was this one. And once you do that, you can call hooks conditionally as much as you like. And it turns out it's really useful for certain things. Like if you want to make a component that depends optionally on a context, like you want it to be able to be used either with a context or directly, depending mm-hmm. on how you want to use it. In traditional React, you would have to make two different versions of that component. With conditional hooks, you don't have to. And in terms of, you know, the code and reasoning about it and what it's doing, it's very simple. It doesn't really add a lot of complexity. It doesn't fundamentally break the rules. It just says, like, hey, if you want to do this, you can. So that's one of the things that I was able to get out of the model, which is really, really nice.
It's interesting stuff. And I get the sense, too, that this is the process that a lot of some of these, because there's like a new wave of frameworks that are trying to be the next React, right? Mm-hmm. Like your Svelte, your Solids, and yeah, and a lot of these are clearly, like, thinking Svelte in particular, like clearly React inspired, right? Like it's, you can tell it was a similar thought exercise was done as you just went through, right? Like, let me take the bits of React I like, but hey, some of this stuff I don't really like, so let's just ditch this. Svelte has like an opinionated way of doing CSS, whereas React doesn't. Like, you can tell that somebody's just like, I want to make, like, recreate React in my own way. And that's how some of these came about. So I don't know where I'm going with this. I guess I'm curious, do you have any plans to try to, like, spread the word on Live to popularize it? Or do you see this more as just your own internal just experiment, a fun place to play with it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm using it to develop a graphics framework. So for me, it's a means to an end. Okay. I just knew I wanted a copy of React without actual React. So then I needed that to do my graphics work. So that is open source. It's already online in an alpha version. So right now it's mostly a demo app with some cool little toys that you can play around with in a web GPU enabled browser. But it is a proof of concept of something big, which I'm hoping to keep growing and turn into sort of a generic toolkit to do graphics well on the web, especially in terms of customization and extensibility. Because there's a lot of great 3D solutions out there, but they're all quite black boxy. Like, if it does what you need it to do, then it's great. But if you need to step outside those bounds, you're kind of stuck, or you have to fork it, so on. So that's what I'm trying to use it for. The nature of that work is it's also a little bit ambitious. It involves GPU programming, shaders, a lot of math. So that in turn also makes it a little bit more niche. But I am doing it all out in the open. You can go look at my code in the horrible state that it sometimes is in, with you know, all the warts in the master branch, because that's how I roll when I'm, you know, just coding for fun and nobody else needs to care. But hopefully it will stabilize. I have already released parts of it as npm packages. I don't want to push stuff out that's unfinished or unreliable or quicksand. That's just not going to help anybody. But stay tuned for sure. It will keep growing and keep getting pushed out there. To your point about the frameworks, by the way, I find it kind of interesting that React pushes in a certain direction, and a lot of what these other frameworks are doing is kind of pulling back a bit, back towards more traditional HTML, CSS. Whereas for me, the decision I made was the complete opposite. It was React is great at HTML, so I don't need to care about it. I'm just using React for HTML. Because why would I build a copy of something that already works perfectly and that other people are maintaining? It's much better if I can, you know, use this model to do novel things in a space where it isn't used, and then just have really good React interoperability, and Bob's your uncle. So
yeah, I find it so cool that you're taking React and just extending it into a space that really hasn't, I think, gotten a lot of, well, I can't speak too deeply about it, but it seems like WebGL kind of got to a certain spot and then just kind of stopped. So as long as you're good with math and really happy to deep dive into that kind of stuff, you can manage it. But if you want to have a nicer API or library or something on top of it to make it easier, it doesn't seem like there really has been that option before. So maybe you could give our listeners and us more of a primer on why you would use WebGL and WebGPU and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. So WebGL and WebGPU is just using the native hardware capabilities that your computer or your mobile phone these days have to render 2D and 3D graphics. It seems super obvious. It seems like it should be super commonplace that we're all trying to do this because it's right there. You know, it's very capable hardware. And for some reason, we don't. Why is that? And I personally, I kind of blame the video game industry in the sense that computer graphics hardware has heavily been, you know, driven by that market. And if you look into, you know, the video game industry, it's not a great place to work. Working conditions are quite bad. They have this problem that there's, you know, a sort of a line of interns by the door just waiting to be hired and just be, you know, crunched to death 60, 80 hours a week. And once they're tired and once they wise up that, you know, maybe this isn't how you want to spend your 20s, there's just new interns that you can go hire. There's a couple of industries that work like this. And the video gaming industry is kind of like this. And so as a result, there's not a lot of sort of efforts to really improve the base technology. It's very project driven. You know, just work to finish the game, do whatever you need to do to get it out the door, and then we move on. There are, of course, things like Unreal Engine and Unity and so on, which are great at what they do. But again, they tend to be sort of, you know, monolithic integrated packages that are mainly designed for a particular kind of graphics, I would say, like, you know, photorealistic or like photorealism, but very little that's like diagrammatic, that's really data viz oriented, mapping, any stuff like that, scientific visualization. It's not great at it. It wasn't the primary use case. So there's just this void of really good software to do this. And that's what I'm trying to focus on and trying to make better. So I don't know if that answers the question.
It's really interesting because it's like one of my pet peeves too, is that for whatever reason, native mobile developers tend to reach for these sort of things. Like, I think if we put the games aside, because obviously games have like high graphic needs, but I feel like there's a lot of apps, and you mentioned some, like just like data visualization, mapping, those sorts of things that could benefit from some really like slick animations and visualizations and graphics and such. And I find that native apps tend to reach into the native hardware far more often than just your average web app. Like it seems like there's a lot less polish for some of these like higher ends, like, you know, even companies that have huge development teams and budgets, they tend not to push the boundaries on the web when it comes to graphics very often. And it's kind of disappointing because a lot of the tech, at least as best I understand, a lot of the tech in the browser is actually there now. It's just severely under leveraged, it feels like.
It's a little bit of column A and column B. The web has the problem that it has to run everywhere. So when it comes to 3D graphics, it's kind of the cheapest, crappiest phone that determines what we're allowed to play with. compared to, you know, a desktop computer with a $1,000 NVIDIA GPU, there's toys in there we can't use on the web. That's just how it is. But you're right that there's a ton of power there. And I think that the answer there is we spend a lot of our energy just getting it to work, mm-hmm. wrangling the DOM, dealing with CSS yeah. and transforms and so on. So that's also an area where I'm just trying to see, like, how much can I get away with just skipping that? If I'm just rendering to a canvas, how much can I do? Can I get a basic box model going? Can I render decent text? And yeah, you can do a lot. And it's a lot of work if everyone would have to do this stuff from scratch. But at the same time, if we had more components for this, I think people would be experimenting a lot more with it. It's sort of, you know, the browser Chrome is set in stone. We can't do anything outside that boundary. But if you had components for that outside part too, it would be a lot simpler. So
yeah. No, it's true. I mean, I've been a web developer for a very long time. I've known about WebGL for a very long time. But if you ask me today, like, oh, you need to implement this on your website, I wouldn't know where in the heck to start, right? Like, I don't know what I could look things up, I'm sure, and try to piece some things together. But I think the fact that there is no very well-known, like, here's what you do to solve this problem, or here's what you go to use this, is kind of telling, because it's not new tech on the web. This has been stuff that's been available, at least in some capacity, for quite a while.
Yeah, it's just because everyone builds a solution for rendering particular things. That's kind of how it's been done in the field. And so you have all these silos that do certain things well, but if you want to, yeah, do anything else, you're kind of on your own. And it's like, well, let's build a team of graphics developers for our little web app. Like, yeah, no, that's not going to fly.
So you mentioned as you were building your own version of React that there were some rules that you rewrote. What else besides conditional hooks did you decide to go in a different direction than the original team?
Oh, well, one thing that I think is really interesting is the notion of morphing. And the best way to introduce this, I would say, is ask the question, why does React Router keep changing its API? No, it's a good question. They're at version 6 already. It's mm-hmm. it's not like routing is, you know, so mysteriously complicated that why did it take them 6 tries? I think that's a good question. And I'm not trying to throw shade on them. I think there's a real problem there, which is when you're routing, you kind of want to make, you know, different pages, different page components, right? To organize your app. But one of the rules of React is if you replace a component of type A with a component of type B, you have to get rid of it. It has to be remounted. You cannot preserve any state from A to B. And of course, when you're actually, you know, making a web app or a website, most of your pages are going to have lots of parts in common, right? And so React basically just throws those away and then mounts them again. It mm-hmm. might keep some of the HTML, but it won't keep the state associated with it, right?
Right.
And so my idea was, well, do we have to? What if I could specifically say, you know, for this kind of scenario where I know I have these, you know, components that are all shaped very similarly, they're really just, you know, interchangeable. I kind of want to treat them as if they were one family of components. This I added to the runtime. It's called morph. So you kind of just wrap a thing in a morph tag, and that signals saying, hey, if you encounter, if there's already an existing morphable component here, just put this one in place and keep all the children. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what it does. It's still going to remount the component of the page in question, but it's going to keep all the children around and just say, like, hey, can I not use any of these? Are any of them still good? That's basically all it does. And I think this is one of those concepts that I think would totally work in React. I don't think there's anything special about it. You just kind of have to realize, like, no, this isn't, you know, a violation of data flow rules. It's not a violation of good taste. It's actually really useful. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of like the conditional hooks. It's one of those like it's like a hazing ritual for new React people, right? When you figure out that this doesn't work, because you kind of intuitively want that state to be preserved when something gets swapped out, because it sure would make your life a whole lot easier if when the header gets re-rendered, if it still knows, you know, what account is information to put up there or whatever the case may be, right? And then when it's not there, and then you have to go like, oh, okay, well, I have to, you know, figure out how to architect this to support this. It's always a bit of a wake up call that that's right. This is how React works. Let me go back and figure out how I need to do this.
Yeah. And so to that, my point about React Router is I think the reason they keep redesigning is because they keep coming up with ways to circumvent this problem, but they can't fix the problem. Mm-hmm. So in the latest API, they have something called outlets as a way to do this. And outlets is really just a children prop in disguise. You know, it's literally the same thing. It's a slot where all the stuff gets put into. It's just a different way of doing the same thing so that you don't have to make a new component out of it. So I think that's why. And I think morphing would be a lot better, but it definitely has to be opt-in. You don't just want to change all the rules of React and say, you know, we're going to keep all the state. We're going to, you know, state for everyone, just like Oprah, because that's also going to change too much. It's going to lose some of those separation guarantees that you actually do also want. And so figuring out when you want behavior A and when you want behavior B is part of the fun.
So I'm here with JD from Raygun. JD, when I talk to you, I mean, I really feel the developer vibe, and I know that's your background, but is all of Raygun that way? I mean, you know, it just kind of feels like when I talk to other companies, they're a little more corporate, a little more, you know, focused on maybe, you know, raising money or doing other things, you know, but it seems like when I talk to you, you're just, you know, down to earth developer dude.
I like to think of myself as a down to earth developer dude. Raygun is a little bit different. You know, we're not heavily VC backed. You know, my business partner and I, when we started, we were both nerds. You know, I might be the CEO today and I don't write code on the product. But, you know, the joke internally is, you know, what's the definition of technical debt, Chuck? It's CEO code. Well, stuff to go fix. We're a cash flow positive business. You know, we're not heavily VC funded. You know, but we are at a size now where we are expanding, and more folks are discovering what we're about. But yeah, we often look through things through that lens of a developer. You know, I wanted a 30,000 foot view, but I also want to go right down to an individual data point. Similarly, you know, I don't believe in averages. I want medians. I want P99s. I make better decisions that way. And so we try and drive that sort of thinking into our products and try and be as developer minded as we possibly can be.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, for me, it's run by people who get me. And you're not under pressure from like a VC to raise your prices or, you know, go hyper grow. And then, oh, crap, now we're behind the eight ball with our money and now we've got to figure it out. You know, you're just going to keep growing, steadily moving. And I just love that.
Yeah, I mean, the term these days is often referred to as product-led growth, right? Like, get people use the product and say, hey, that's great. I want to give you money. I don't think it's that complicated.
Sounds good. Well, folks, if you want to go check it out, you can go find them at raygun.com. You can actually sign up for a free trial right there on the website.
I have to imagine memory could also get out of control, too, if you were tracking all the things in a really complex app. Or am I thinking about that wrong?
No, it's not going to track anymore. It's literally just saying, you know, like, because React already keeps the whole tree of your components in memory. That's why you can inspect it in the dev tools. And so the only thing that's changing is just saying, like, hey, even though this component changed type, just don't throw away the children just yet. Just wait and see if any of them are still good.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yep.
Have you thought about either suggesting these or like opening some pull requests on the React core team for some of these things that you're doing? Because like you said, a lot of them are still in the spirit of React. And especially if they put it behind an opt-in flag, maybe other people would find it just as useful as you are.
Oh, quite possibly. The thing is, I only have so many hours in a day, so that's my excuse for not opening a React pull request. I would also say, you know, Facebook certainly has the means to copy what I did. So if they want to, they are more than welcome to. I you know, I'm not going to say no. But that's unfortunately where I have to leave it today. Like, I don't have a lot of time to become a core React contributor, for sure.
Yeah, that's one of the benefits of having your own fork, right? You also don't have the, like, not that your code wouldn't be polished, but like the getting stuff like that across the finish line for a project that operates at the scale of React is, I have to imagine, is an absolutely enormous investment in terms of time, resources, et cetera.
Yeah.
For like, I mean, some notoriety, I guess, if that's what you're going for, but it's just like, I mean, no one's going to pay you to do that, right? So it's a whole lot of time to sink in.
Yeah. I would also say, you know, just the fact that it's patterned after React is, I think, a decision that I'm really happy with, because I could have just I could have said in certain places, well, I'm making my own version of React, so why didn't I go crazy? Why didn't I do what Svelte and Next and all the other guys do? I just say, like, let's change as much as we can. And I explicitly didn't do that just so that I can say, like, hey, do you know React? Then take a look at this.
Yeah. Then you'll automatically,
you know exactly what's going on. It has exactly, you know, it reads exactly the same, has the same JSX. There's a couple of additions that change the rules a little bit, but it's not, you know, world changing. It feels like it could just be, you know, React 20 that's just here early in that regard. Yeah.
So what were some of the WebGL and WebGPU things that you wanted to, that you want this version of React to be able to do? Because that's very interesting to me, is like, what could you potentially do with this new version?
It's really just making it simpler. No, but it's difficult to explain this. This is what, because I've been trying to explain to a lot of people how, what this project is about, what Live is, what the graphics framework, which is called Use GPU. And it's called Use GPU because it's all hooks. So the word use is just nice. Everywhere. I'm trying to explain this because it's not that there's anything particularly novel that you cannot do today. It's making it dramatically simpler. Exactly the same way that, you know, React didn't necessarily allow you to build things that you could not build before. It was perfectly possible in theory to build UIs of exactly the same complexity. You just didn't. And why didn't you? Well, because it was spaghetti. It was a nightmare. You took ages just to get it working, and then you didn't want to mess with it because it's
right.
Like, yeah. But now with React, when it's declarative, you kind of do want to tinker with it. It invites playing around with it. And so that's really what I'm trying to bring to it. It's kind of hard to explain because it's like, you know, people who are in the graphics scene say, well, I can already do all this. What's the added value? And it's like, well, yes, because you spent years building up all your expertise and all your libraries and all your things. So now you're comfy. But somebody from the outside, they're going to like, well, I don't know anything about graphics. Why should I prefer your thing? And it's like, it's just simpler. That's it.
Yeah, I feel like you're talking to your target audience here, because like Paige and I both have, you know, JavaScript React background, but virtually zero WebGL stuff. And it is super intimidating. So anything that makes it easier. And by the way, Use GPU is a fantastic name. You should totally keep that.
That's what it does. It lets you use the GPU.
So do you envision, just to go like a little one step further into your like, let's just paint a picture of the future where all your work is done. It's worked amazingly. Is Use GPU, are you passing that things like components, like building blocks? Like I want to render a box here, right? Like, is it going to seem more like Canvas, or are you building up like a tree of components that gets rendered to WebGL instead of HTML through Canvas?
Yes.
I'm just sort of curious what you see the rendering sort of pipeline looking like in a WebGL world.
Yeah, this is the magic trick. That's, again, it's one of those things that's hard to explain. What you do in React is you use your component tree to produce an HTML tree, right?
Yep.
And then that HTML tree is your description of what needs to go onto the screen. What I find myself often doing is realizing I don't need a second tree of objects. What I really need is a tree of code. And it's sort of like I'm assembling a program at runtime, just a bunch of little snippets of code, one associated with each component, basically, right? Like, instead of rendering a div, I just render a little function and say, hey, go call this when it's time to do this. And so your componentry kind of just turns into a program that gets just run top to bottom. And that's what ends up happening. So even though it feels exactly like kind of like you described, you've got components to represent various sorts of things that you plug together into a tree, it doesn't really get turned into another representation. It kind of just sort of dissolves into code that runs and does the right thing. And that's, I think, what's really neat about this approach is, you know, React was created in order to tame the DOM, but it's even better when there's no DOM in the way, when you can just go all the way to the end. That's basically the magic here. And I think that's still easy to explain to web developers, because I think web developers are just going to be automatically enthused about anything that makes the DOM even more irrelevant. It's just nice. But for graphics developers, this is all just like, I'm talking moon language. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
it's just so far out of how they tend to approach it. Mm-hmm. I think they would look at my code and just be horrified at how inefficient it is. And it's just like, well, I'm not rendering Doom. I'm rendering diagrams. Like,
you don't need 60 FPS.
Oh no, I need 60 FPS. It's just it's not hard to get 60 FPS because it's. I'm not rendering Doom. Like,
yeah, I bet you get a lot of comments like, why do you need to do this? And to which the answer is you need like a lot of time to explain the browsers work differently.
Yeah.
So do you have some examples of seeing this? You said at the beginning that there were some live examples of this engine. What kind of demos do you have for people who want to kind of their toes into it and play around with it a little bit?
The demo is it's a React app that launches live. And I'm just using, like I said, React for HTML because it's good at it. But it builds a canvas, and then there's various little demos, just some 3D geometry, a basic sort of math plot of a 3D diagram. I've got some box model stuff. So, you know, a page with some boxes with some text in it that you can scroll, and some flexbox-like things going on. Basic, you know, that's the thing. None of it is particularly impressive. All of it you can do with other tools. It's just like, hey, look at how simple this is now.
Yeah.
That's really it. So it's both, if you understand what it's doing, it can be impressive. But otherwise, I think it might be underwhelming until I can actually, you know, put some time into making some really neat showcases.
Are you using it on your own website right now?
Well, no. So a web GPU, to be fair, I should probably clarify this. It's not really available yet for everyone. So you can turn it on in a dev version of Chrome, but you can't really use it in public. So this is another reason why publicizing this is so hard, because I have to record everything on video just to show it. Because otherwise, you know, people just get a box that doesn't do anything. And they're like, I'm not going to download your thing just to look at it. Like, yeah. That's not how things work anymore. So I have to make videos.
I remember that being a common complaint of the Houdini API, which is finally starting to get to actual usability in Chrome and Firefox and things like that. It's like people would go to the example sites on MDN and things, and it wouldn't work because they were on the wrong browser or the wrong version. It's just like, yeah, it's kind of not fun when it's like you've got to go to the latest nightly release to actually see this thing in action.
Yeah, the best thing is just record videos. It saves you a lot of hassle.
So one question that I don't think I realized until you just mentioned this. So WebGPU versus WebGL, because I know WebGPU, the extent that I understand it is WebGPU is like the newer version, right? Like the more advanced version. But is it like a completely new set of APIs? Can you like write WebGPU code that like also can run in a WebGL environment? Like how exactly do those work together or not work together?
Yes, they don't work together at all, really.
Okay.
And the reason is WebGL is basically ancient. What happened was it's like I said before, it's mobile phones that are really driving what we're allowed to play with in a browser. So WebGL was modeled after the kinds of graphics you could get on like first, second gen iPhones, essentially. So 2007, 2008 is kind
of... Wow.
Yeah, it's computer years are worse than dog years. So that's ancient history. And there's been, of course, some updates, and there has been a WebGL 2 that was made, which definitely, you know, had a couple of improvements, but was still fundamentally the same thing. And it's still that same API from, you know, good 15 years ago. And OpenGL really is much older than that. So this is really 25 years or longer. So WebGPU is modeled after the more recent generation of graphics APIs, be it your Metal, Vulkan. So Metal is Apple. Vulkan is kind of the replacement for OpenGL. So it's the open solution, kind of like OpenGL was before. And then Microsoft has their Direct3D. So there's a lot of fragmentation too, which isn't great, but that's what we're forced to deal with. But that does mean that WebGPU is kind of positioned perfectly as, oh, and this is a horrible thing to say, the Java of GPU graphics? No.
No. Yeah.
Horrible analogy. The Unicode of, no, that's even worse. Oh, Jesus. No, it's meant to be, you know, it harmonizes a lot of differences between those different platforms and gives you a common baseline that is relatively sane and well-supported. So what's really interesting is whereas WebGL was kind of just a desperate attempt to get GL to work on the web, WebGPU is more just like, no, actually, a lot of people could agree and benefit from this standard even outside of a browser. So that there's, for example, a Rust implementation of it called WGPU, which allows you to use WebGPU natively without any browser. And it's, you know, it's the exact same API, so you can potentially write code that could run in both environments really easily as well.
So is the browser then doing some of the heavy lifting of, in terms of just, because presumably there's code somewhere that has to talk Vulkan language, talk Metal language, talk Direct3D, and just make that work behind like one coherent API. So I'm assuming like the Chrome engineers, Firefox engineers, etc., are some of the ones doing the lifting and the translation so that the browser gets like one semi-sane API to work with.
Yep, exactly. And this is a very slow process.
I was just thinking like, I was not, it just sounds not fun.
It takes a certain kind of person.
Yeah,
that's for sure. I'm much happier being on the consuming side of it. I did do some early work with WGPU to contribute to some of, you know, very minor things. So it's not totally foreign to me, but yeah, it's not super great. And in part, this is also, you know, there's the theory of what those APIs can do. And then there's the practice of, okay, what's actually out there in the wild in terms of devices? How bad is it? Is it, you know, is it just as bad as we thought it was, or is it worse? Spoiler, it's worse.
But. I was just going to say, it's probably not better.
Is there some sort of future proofing built into like this time around? Like, because like, I'm just picturing, you know, Apple decides we've come up with an entirely new way of handling graphics and such. Presumably then it would be on the browser vendors to like talk to these new APIs to make sure that WebGPU continues to operate as expected on like any sort of newer APIs or hardware that comes out.
Yes, definitely. It kind of depends on where, you know, the market is going, where the devices go. There's definitely an evolution towards more generic processors. So it used to be that I don't know, back in the day, back way back, with 3DFX and those really early vendors, what that hardware did was really specialized. There was really only one particular thing you could do with it. And since then, they've become much more general processors. Now you can do general compute on a GPU. But there's also been a recent wave, for example, of new ray tracing tech, it's called. So this is used to do reflections, complex lighting, anything that you can't just basically cheat, where you can't get away with little tricks and you actually have to get the light physics right. That's what ray tracing is for. That's not really available in WebGPU. Hopefully it'll show up one day, but there's going to be, you know, years of lag time, and it's a very slow process with multiple steps. First, the hardware and the capabilities have to be available enough that you can reasonably expect that everybody can make use of it. Then you have to figure out a sane and secure API for it. And then people can finally, you know, start to write engines and tools around it to get it in the hands of, you know, application developers and so on. So it's going to take a while. And I think a lot of the reason why, yeah, graphics development is not a happy time is because it's just always dealing with that legacy problem. We all know it could be better. It's just a matter of, can we make it better today without working ourselves to death? Yeah.
I feel like that's where the bigger, like the Unities of the world, or I guess I should say like the Unreal, and like those types of I guess, solutions, for lack of a better word, do so well, mm-hmm. because most people just don't want to care
right.
about any of that, because you can get bogged down really, really
for quickly. Sure. And they try to, you know, they too evolve towards more generic architecture, more flexibility. I know the Unity engineers have spent some really lot of effort on coming up with what they call, you know, modular rendering pipelines or pluggable rendering pipelines, which is basically the same thing that, you know, that I want to do with React, is just give you Legos that you can plug together to just do what you want. And have a lot of the orchestration just happen automatically. I just don't think they're quite as far. Like the web with React has really, I think, stumbled upon a really good pattern that had just, you know, a perfect application domain, which is UI, which everybody needs UI. So we've had several years now of really plumbing the depths of potential here, I think. You know, like we've gone through the honeymoon phase, and we're now in that solid plateau of, yeah, we know how this works. We know some things were follies, like Redux, but other things we're really happy with, like render props, contexts. Yeah, those well-established workhorses now of the React world. And I think some of those are just in other programming domains, those patterns are not well known. And
yeah.
It's really quite hard even to convince people that they would like them and that they might appreciate them.
Change is scary.
Pretty much, yeah.
Is
job security isn't so...
right.
I'm curious, like, have there been any attempts from some of the bigger players in this industry to build something like what you're talking about? Like, because it seems like some people, like maybe the Unity team, for example, could build like a far lighter weight version of their engine for people to use for web apps and like sell licenses for it. Has anybody tried that? Is there just not enough incentive? Because I don't think anything like that exists.
No, and like I said, they have taken some initial steps to making it a little bit more modular. But I think also for them, still the bread and butter is just that really high end performance tier. You know, Unreal and Unity are competing against each other mostly. They're not really competing with data visualization solutions or mapping solutions. And so everyone's kind of just saying, well, we need to do some rendering. I guess we'll use Unreal, or I guess we'll use Unity, even if they're not really even meant for that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's overkill, but it's what's available. So we'll just use it and not utilize most of it.
Yeah. And I definitely don't want to, you know, say that the graphics industry hasn't also tried. Like, and NVIDIA in particular, they've been doing some good work with building tooling and libraries and so on. But it is still, it's a very different world. And in some ways, it just feels like this is what's so hard, right? Web developers going to the graphics developers and saying, hey, we've got some really good ideas that we think you should copy. It's just like, I don't know what would be a good analogy for that, but it's kind of, you know, it's like bringing pork to a vegan barbecue. It's
like, reminds me of like in sports, it's like the analytics, like the nerdy analytics statisticians walking into a locker room and saying, like, I think you should try, you know, this different approach. It's like, yeah, the analyst might have
You're going to get beat up, basically.
Yeah, exactly. The analytics might have good suggestions, but like, you know, the professional athletes are going to look at that and go like,
I think in part the reason I get away with it is because I do actually have quite a long history. So, and you know, I do know how to write assembly code and C and all that jazz. I just don't because I know better.
But. Yeah. You can talk the talk and walk the walk.
Yes.
Got credibility. Well, Stephen, this has been awesome talking to you. Is there anything that we have not covered yet that you think we should?
Oh. Well, yeah, there is one more part of extending React that I think is very interesting. A basic rule, again, of React is one-way data flow from the top to the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Which means children come after their parents. But sometimes you end up in a situation where you wish the parent could do some things after the children were done.
Yes.
And it seems like that would, you know, violate the one-way direction rule of React. And people do, you know, various tricks with like callbacks and stuff where, you know, the parent passes a callback down to the child and the child is then going to immediately call back. And you get these little mini cycles that are just like, I mean, they're cursed, basically. You don't want that stuff in your code. It's just, it's inviting trouble. But how do you avoid that? And basically, my answer to that is you imagine you've got a JSX tree. What if that closing tag at the bottom was not just decoration? What if there was actually just a component there? What if you could do stuff in there? What if you could put code in there that actually gets a result from the children? Mm. And that's basically, and it's not a new concept. It's what's called continuations often in programming. Because this is getting into, you know, programming language theory stuff. But it's a very simple idea. It's just, you know, after the children are done, I want the parents to get a chance to do some stuff again. So I added that into the runtime too. And you can do some really neat stuff with that. Because you basically say, I'm going to have my children at the end, the leaves. Some of them are going to produce some kind of value. You know, it might be anything. And I'm just going to gather them all up and collect them back at a root. And, you know, I'll reduce them with some kind of rule. Often it's just like I'm just putting them all in one big array. I don't really care about, you know, where they came from originally. I just want to maintain them in the order that they were rendered in. Kind of just like HTML, right? And then, yeah, that parent has just collected all that stuff from that chunk of subtree and can now do new things. It can render new components and so on. And you apply this pattern, you can build anything this way. I built a box model this way. So flex, inline, block, just purely by doing these sorts of tree reductions where it's like a parent renders some children and then those children return some values back and then, you know, the parent resumes and does stuff with it. It's a very simple pattern. It's just something you're normally not allowed to do in React or you can't do it in React. But once you add it back, you see why it's super useful. And this isn't new. This is, like I said, it's continuations. Another name for this is really effect-based programming, which is what React is, really, because every component returns a description of what's going to happen next, right? You return JSX, but that JSX doesn't do anything. It's just a description. So that's what formerly is called an effect. You know, I'm arranging for something to be happening. I'm not going to run it yet. I'm just going to describe it. That's an effect. So you can think of React components as effects that produce new effects. And the tricky part or the clever part is that React, you know, remembers parts of the tree. Most effect systems don't do this. But that's the part that's the most interesting to me. And I think that's the part that makes it so different from traditional solutions is that because that allows you to basically offload all the bookkeeping to the runtime, which is the annoying code. Anytime you have, you know, terrible, annoying, messy code, I guarantee you it's going to have something to do with bookkeeping or orchestration of resources. Like,
yeah,
that's just bad mojo. You don't want it.
I'm thinking of so many instances where I've had to do exactly what you're describing, either with context or with passing functions down and then passing them back up. And it is always a pain.
Yeah, it never feels good.
No.
Nope. So this is why the post, to tie it all back up, was called React the Missing Parts. Because it feels, once you have these tools, you're just like, yeah, I wish I had them in the real thing. I don't know if I'm lobbying effectively enough for these things to ever appear in real React, but maybe this podcast will help. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think so. So if people want to get in touch with you, learn more about you, maybe start contributing to some of these things that you're working on, where's the best places to find you on the line?
The crazy website with the crazy header. So acko.net, acko.net is probably a good place to start. And my handle on pretty much everything is unconed, UNCONED. So GitHub, GitLab, social media, all those things. I'm around, basically.
Perfect. Cool.
Hi, this is Charles Max Wood from Top End Devs, and lately I've been coaching some people on starting some podcasts and in some cases just taking their career to the next level. You know, whether you're beginner going to intermediate, intermediate going to advanced, whether you're trying to get noticed in the community or go freelance, I've been helping these folks figure out how to get in front of people, how to build relationships and how to build their careers and max out and just go to the next level. So if you're interested in talking to me and having me help you go to the next level, go to topendevs.com/coaching. I will give you a 1-hour free session where we can figure out what you're trying to do, where you're trying to go, and figure out what the next steps are. And then from there, we can figure out how to get you to the place you want to go. So once again, that's topendevs.com/coaching.
So this is the part of the show where we move into picks, and these could be technical things, books you've read, products you've purchased that you think our listeners would like. So I will start us off for this week My pick is going to be a Netflix series that I've been watching, and I think a lot of people have been watching as well, called Inventing Anna. And it is a dramedy of what actually happened back in 2016, where this heiress took New York by storm. And she was a European heiress from Germany or Russia or somewhere thereabouts, but she was also the best con artist that I think has ever just gone through high society. And it's all about how she convinced these people of her background and her pedigree and flew private planes and rented just ridiculous hotel rooms and spent money and was going to build this social club. And it's just, it gets more and more crazy the longer you watch this series. And I think it's maybe 9 or 10 episodes, but it's also unbelievable the amount of stuff that she was able to make happen in such a short amount of time and with basically nothing besides her wits and some voice changing software and some fake phone numbers. And it's really impressive. So if you want to watch something that is based on a true story, but also has lots of elements of drama added to it for fun, Inventing Anna is going to be my pick for this week.
Interesting.
TJ, what do you have for us?
So I'm going to pick a show called Moon Knight, which is on Disney Plus. It's like the latest Disney Marvel show. The show is kind of bonkers a few episodes in, because Disney's done this with a lot of their Marvel stuff recently, but especially this one, because it's about a superhero that struggles with multiple personalities. And because of that, like, there's very much a vibe of you're not sure what is real and what isn't. There's a lot of mysteries, which it's the type of show I tend to like. I like those sort of like drama. You're not sure what's going on. I will say I usually like those shows when you do understand what happened at the end. So maybe I should be waiting till the show is over before I pick it. But because shows like Lost in the past, really just drug me in. I was super into it and it wasn't the most satisfying end to it. But if you like shows like that as well, Moon Knight is pretty good. So that's my pick.
Nice. That sounds good. Steven, do you have a pick for us?
Yeah, I'm going to pick something that's not new. It's a video game called The Talos Principle. And what it is basically a very clever puzzle game. And the reason I'm picking it is because the experience of building live my React clone and trying to figure out a good way to do graphics programming reminded me of playing this game. Because as a puzzle game, it has this really good quality that it always dares you to figure out ways to break the rules and do more with less. It will teach you certain things and allow you to solve certain scenarios. And then you encounter the same problem, but there's one piece missing. And you're like, well, I can't solve this now. I don't have the right pieces.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, the game is asking you to solve it. And then it turns out you really think about it. It's like, oh, you didn't need that piece all along. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I think thematically, it fits with this podcast, but also it's just a really well crafted game. It's really fun. It'll definitely, challenge you, but not in a mean way. And it's just a good time. So
that's very interesting.
Cool. Yeah.
I'm sucked into the trailer right now. So
it's got good vibes, I think people say these days.
Well, Steven, thanks again for joining us today. It's been really fun to talk to you and hear about how you're improving React in your own unique ways to solve the problems.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been great to nerd out about this stuff.
Well, I would say that is another episode of React Roundup. So we will see you all next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.